Hachette Audio presents The Christmas Train. Written by David Baldacci. Read by Tim Matheson. Featuring a bonus story, Waiting for Santa. Read by Brad Negbar.
Tom Langdon was a journalist, a globetrotting one, because it was in his blood to roam widely. Where others saw only instability and fear in life, Tom felt graced by an embracing independence. He'd spent the bulk of his career in foreign lands, covering wars, insurrections, famines, pestilence, virtually every earthly despair. His goal had been relatively simple. He had wanted to change the world by calling attention to its wrongs. And he did love adventure. However, after chronicling all these horrific events, and still seeing the conditions of humanity steadily worsen, he'd returned to America filled with disappointment. Seeking an antidote to his melancholy, he'd started writing drearily light stories for ladies' magazines, home decorating journals, garden digests, and the like. However, after memorializing the wonders of compost and the miracle that was do-it-yourself wood flooring, he wasn't exactly fulfilled. It was nearing Christmas, and Tom's most pressing dilemma was getting from the East Coast to Los Angeles for the holidays. He had an age-old motivation for the journey. In L.A. was his girlfriend, Lelia Gibson. She'd started out as a movie actress, but after years of appearing in third-rate horror films, she'd begun doing voiceover work. Now, instead of being cinematically butchered for her daily bread, she supplied the character voices for a variety of enormously popular Saturday morning cartoons. In the children's television industry, it was accepted that no one belted out the voices of goofy woodland creatures with greater flair and versatility than golden-piped Lelia Gibson. As proof, she had a shelf full of awards, an outrageously large income, and a healthy share of syndication rights. Tom and Lelia had hit it off on an overnight flight from Southeast Asia to the States. At first he thought it might have been all the liquor they drank, but when that buzz burned off a couple hours out of L.A., she was still beautiful and interesting, if a little ditzy and eccentric, and she still seemed attracted to him. He stayed over in California and they got to know each other even better. She visited him on the East Coast, and they'd been a comfortable, if informal, bi-coastal item ever since. It might seem strange that a successful Hollywood lady would go for a nomadic gent who ran through passports like water, could spout off funny if lewd phrases in 30 languages, and never would be financially secure. Yet Lelia had tired of the men in her circle. As she diplomatically explained it once, they were complete and total lying scum, and unreliable to boot. Tom was a newsman, she said, so at least he occasionally dealt with the truth. She also loved his rugged good looks. He took that to mean the deep lines etched on his face from reporting in windswept desert climates with bullets flying. In fact, his face was more often than not down in the sand in observance of local safety regulations. She listened with rapt attention to Tom's tales of covering major stories around the globe. For his part, he observed with admiration the professional way Lelia went about her loony voice career. And they didn't have to live together year-round, a decided advantage, Tom believed, over the complex hurdles facing couples who actually cohabitated. He'd been briefly married but had never had kids. Today, his ex-wife wouldn't accept a collect call from him if he were hemorrhaging to death on the street. He was 41 and had just lost his mother to a stroke. His father had been dead for several years. Being an only child, he was truly alone now, and that had made him introspective. Half his time on Earth was gone, and all he had to show for it was a failed marriage, no offspring, an informal alliance with a California voiceover queen, a truckload of newsprint, and some awards. By any reasonable measure, it was a miserable excuse for an existence. He'd had an opportunity for a wonderful life with another woman, but the relationship had, inexplicably, fallen apart. He now fully understood that not marrying Eleanor Carter would forever stand as the major mistake of his life. Yet, ever the man of action and wanderlust upon him once more, Tom was taking the train to L.A. for Christmas. Why the train, one might ask, when there were perfectly good flights that would get him there in a fraction of the time? Well, a guy can only take so many of those airport security search wands venturing into sacrosanct places, or requests to drop trousers in front of strangers, or ransacking of carry-on bags before blowing a big one. The fact was, he'd blown a big one at LaGuardia Airport. Not merely a nuclear meltdown, his detonation resembled something closer to the utter destruction of Pompeii. He'd just flown in from Italy after researching yet another bit of fluff, this time on winemaking, and imbibing more of the subject matter than he probably should have to get through the ordeal of crash-learning soil diversification and vine rot. As a result, he was tired, cranky, and hungover. He'd slept for 3 hours at a friend's apartment in New York before heading to the airport to catch a flight to Texas. He'd been given an assignment to write about teen beauty pageants there, which he'd accepted because he enjoyed blood sports as much as the next person. At the security gate at LaGuardia, the search wand had smacked delicate things of Tom's person that it really had no business engaging, socially or otherwise. Meanwhile, another security person managed to dump every single thing from Tom's bag onto the conveyor belt. He watched helplessly as very personal possessions rolled by in front of suddenly interested strangers. To put a fine finish on this very special moment, he was then informed that a major warning flag had been raised regarding his ID, his hair color, his clothing choice, or the size of his nose. They were never really clear on that, actually. Thus, instead of flying to Dallas, he'd be enjoying the company of a host of FBI, DEA, CIA, and NYPD personnel for an unspecified period of time. The phrase 5 to 10 was even bandied about. Well, that, coupled with his exploited physical parts, was his absolute limit. So, the lava poured forth. Langdon was 6'2" and carried about 220 pounds of fairly hard muscle, and real honest-to-God steam was coming out his ears. His eruption involved language he ordinarily wouldn't use within 4 miles of any church, as he launched himself at the security team, grabbed their infamous search wand, and snapped it right in half. He wasn't proud of his violent act that day, although the rousing cheers from some of the other passengers who had heard and seen what had happened to him did manage to lift his spirits a bit. Thankfully, the magistrate Tom appeared before had recently endured airport security of an extremely overzealous nature, and when he gave his testimony, she and Tom shared a knowing look. Also, the red flag raised at the security gate had been, shockingly, a mistake. Thus, Tom only received a stern warning, with instructions to enroll in anger management classes, which he planned to do as soon as his uncontrollable urge to maim the fellow with the search wand subsided. However, the other consequence of the blow-up was that he'd been banned from placing his miserable person on any air carrier that flew within the continental United States for the next 2 years. He hadn't thought they could do that, but then he was shown the appropriate statutory power in the microscopic print of the airline's legal manifesto under the equally tiny section titled Lost Luggage Liability Limit, $5. And that's when he had his epiphany. Being unable to fly, his usual and necessary way of traveling, was an omen. It had to be a sign of something divine, something important. Thus, he was going to take the train to L.A. He was going to write a story about it, traveling by rail from sea to shining sea during the Christmas season. He had a grand motivation beyond spending the holiday with Lelia. Tom Langdon was one of the Elmira, New York Langdons. To those with a keen knowledge of literary history, the Elmira Langdons brought to mind Olivia Langdon. Olivia, besides having been a lovely, resilient, if ultimately tragic person in her own right, gained lasting fame by marrying the loquacious orator, irascible personality, and prolific scribe known to his friends as Samuel Clemens, but otherwise known to the world and to history as Mark Twain. Tom had known of this familial connection since he was old enough to block letter his name. It had always inspired him to earn his living with words, for Twain had also been a journalist, starting at the Territorial Enterprise in Virginia City, Nevada, before going on to fame, fortune, bankruptcy, and then fame and fortune again. Tom, for his part, had been imprisoned twice by terrorist groups and very nearly killed half a dozen times, covering a variety of wars, skirmishes, coups, and revolutions that civilized societies used to settle their differences. He'd seen hope replaced with terror, terror replaced with anger, anger replaced with, well, nothing, for the anger always seemed to stick around and make trouble for everybody. Though he'd won major awards, he believed he wasn't a writer with the ability to create memorable prose that would stand tall and strong over the eons. Not like Mark Twain. Yet to have even a marginal connection to the creator of Huckleberry Finn, Life on the Mississippi, and the man who corrupted Hadleyburg, a man whose work was timeless, made Tom feel wonderfully, if vicariously, special. Shortly before he died, Tom's father had asked his son to finish something that, according to legend, Twain never had. As his father told it, Mark Twain, who probably traveled more than any man of his time, had taken a transcontinental railroad trip over the Christmas season during the latter part of his life, his so-called dark years. Apparently, he'd wanted to see some good in the world amid all the tragedy he and his family had suffered. He'd supposedly taken extensive notes about the trip, but for some reason had never distilled them into a story. That's what Tom's father had asked him to do. Take the train ride, write the story, finish what Twain never had, and do the Langdon side of the family proud. At the time, Tom had just finished a frantic 20-hour plane odyssey from overseas to see his dad before he passed. When Tom heard his mumbled request, he was struck dumb. Travel across the country on a train during Christmas to finish something Mark Twain allegedly hadn't? He had thought his father delirious with his final suffering, and so his dad's wish went unfulfilled. Yet now, because he could no longer fly in the lower 48, unless he was fingerprinted and shackled, he was finally going to take that trip for his old man, and maybe for himself, too. Over almost 3,000 miles of America, he was going to see if he could find himself. He was doing it during the Christmas season because that was supposed to be a time of renewal, and for him, perhaps, a last chance to clean up whatever mess he'd made of himself. At least he was going to try. However, had he known what life-altering event would happen to him barely 2 hours after he boarded the train, he might have opted to walk to California instead. The Capital Limited, Washington, D.C. to Chicago. Chapter 2. As he got out of the cab in front of Union Station in Washington, D.C., where his train trip would begin, Tom reflected on the few rail journeys he'd taken in the United States. They'd all been along the Northeast Corridor, the routes between D.C., New York, and Boston, on the newest Amtrak equipment, the Acela high-speed trains. Fast, beautiful, and spacious, these trains were easily in the class of their European cousins. They had cool glass doors between train cars that slid open when one approached, reminding Tom of the portal on the bridge of the Starship Enterprise. Indeed, the first time Tom was on the Acela and those doors slid open, he started looking around for a Vulcan in a Starfleet dress uniform. Tom had reservations in a sleeping car compartment on the Capital Limited train that would carry him from D.C. to Chicago. He actually had to take two trains to get to the West Coast. The Capital Limited constituted the first leg, and the venerable Southwest Chief would handle the second and much longer jaunt. The Capital Limited had a storied history, being part of the fabled Baltimore and Ohio line. The B&O was the first common carrier train company in the United States, and it also held the distinction of being the first to actually haul people. The Cap, as the Limited was affectionately known, was always considered the most stylish and sophisticated long-distance train in the country. It had once boasted lobster Newburgh on the menu, and china and real glass in the dining room, and fancy domed train cars out of which to see the countryside roll by. It also had Pullman cars with legendary Pullman car attendants, who made, it was said, tips of enormous proportion. In its long history, the Cap had carried kings and princes and presidents and movie stars and titans of industry from Chicago to D.C. and back again, and the stories that poured forth from these trips constituted a legendary part of railroad lore. Tom could have had a lucrative career as a society reporter, simply covering the ribald antics of train passengers on that route. In his youth, because of the family connection and his father's great interest in the man, Tom had immersed himself in Mark Twain's life, work, and wit. In preparation for his transcontinental trip, he'd reread The Innocents Abroad, Twain's account of a five-month journey on the steamship Quaker City to Europe and the Holy Land. He thought it one of the funniest, most irreverent travel books ever written. If one could imagine Sam Clemens, then a raw-boned man fresh from the Wild West, very removed from the world-famous, sophisticated man of letters he'd become, in the company of a boatload of pious Midwesterners on their first sojourn to the Old World, the outrageous possibilities became readily apparent. Tom wasn't going abroad, but in many ways he felt like a pilgrim traveler in his own country, because ironically, he'd seen far more of the rest of the world than he had of America. The Capital Limited left D.C. at precisely 4:05 p.m., made 12 stops between Washington, D.C. and Chicago, and arrived the following morning in the Windy City punctually at 9:19 a.m. Tom had a layover in Chicago until that afternoon, where he'd board the Southwest Chief and sail on to L.A. It was a good plan, and it got his juices going in a way that articles detailing the best times to prune one's holly trees or pump out one's septic tank never had. He picked up his tickets, checked his ski equipment with the baggage agent. Lelia and he were going to the elegantly chic slopes of Tahoe for Christmas, and observed the grandeur of Union Station, which before it was revitalized came very close to falling victim to the wrecking ball. In the late 1960s, it had become the National Visitor's Center, basically a broken slideshow in a big hole that no one ever visited. After that $30 million misfire, the National Visitor's Center, with no visitors, was quietly closed except for one tiny and leaky part of the building where one could, of all things, actually board a train. Tom's father, returning from the Second World War in 1945, had come through this Romanesque-style train terminal on his way home. As Tom walked through the lavishly sculpted and adorned marble halls, he imagined himself retracing his father's optimistic steps back to the safety of civilian life after helping to save the world from tyranny with nothing more than a gun and a young man's courage. It seemed fitting that Tom should start his journey here, since his father had ended one life and begun another through this portal. The son could only hope to do as much. Tom took a few minutes to look at the enormous model Christmas train set up in the main hall's west end. The area was packed with children and adults, doubtless intrigued by the miniature metal creations racing through elaborately built town and country sets. Trains had a nostalgic magnetism that was undeniable, even for the many Americans who'd never even been on one. In this spirit, Tom found himself smiling broadly as the little cars whizzed by on the tiny tracks. The train would be boarding shortly, so he headed to the departure area. Even though some train stations had recently implemented baggage screening, a person could still literally arrive at the last minute and make their ride. There were no security checkpoints, no nosy wands, no inane questions about whether you'd let a complete stranger load a small thermonuclear device in your carry-on bag while you were in the men's room, as though you wouldn't have volunteered such information on your own. You just jumped on and went. In the modern world of endless rules, the simplicity of it all was actually very refreshing. Tom sat down in the cab waiting area and began studying his fellow passengers. When he had ridden the Acela to New York, virtually all the waiting passengers had been business people, dressed sharply and outfitted with all sorts of corporate weapons: cell phones, Blackberries, Palm Pilots, laptops, ear receivers, laser-guided power pointers, plutonium-charged thingamajigs, and hard drive ready to wear. These were people with a mission, raring to go, And when that door opened to let the masses board, they boarded with a vengeance. Tom nearly had all his clothes stripped off because he didn't step fast enough. One tiny but determined CEO bore down on him like he was holding a little red cape, her sole purpose in life being to expose his entrails to the open air. The group waiting for the cap was more varied. There were whites and African Americans and Native Americans, Muslims dressed in traditional garb, Asian Americans, a nice sampling of ethnicity and origins, pretty equally split between men and women. An attractive young couple sitting next to Tom were sipping Diet Cokes and holding hands, looking very nervous. Perhaps this was their first time away from home. Tom had traveled so much at a young age that he could relate to the anxiety they might be feeling. Next to them was an elderly man of the cloth taking a little siesta, his feet up on his duffel. Sitting across from the priest was a slender woman with very angular features, a geometric project honed from skin and bone. Tom couldn't really tell her age because she was wearing a long, multicolored scarf around her head, almost like a turban. She also wore wooden shoes the size of 30-pound dumbbells. Spread on the chair next to her were tarot cards, which she was studiously poring over. When anyone passed, she'd glance up with a look that seemed to say, "I know all about you." It was a little unnerving, actually. Tom had had his palm read by an old fellow in the Virgin Islands once. He'd promised Tom a long life filled with a passel of kids, a loving wife, and nothing but good times. Tom had often thought about hunting the liar down and getting his money back. He watched one elderly lady maneuvering around on a walker. She reminded him of his mother. After her stroke, she couldn't speak, so he'd concocted a little system. He'd lay a photo of her and himself when he was a boy on his mother's chest, and she'd pick it up with her good hand. That meant things were okay, that she was still there. He'd never forget the time he laid the photo down and waited 8 hours for her to pick it up. She never did. She died the next day. A few minutes later, Tom and the other passengers all grabbed their bags and headed out. The mighty Capital Limited was calling his name.
Aboard!
Chapter 3. Outside, the air was very cold, the fat clouds holding the promise of snow, or at least sleet. In such weather, airplane passengers worried about flight delays and icy wings, but such inclemency meant nothing to the stalwart Cap. It was bound for Chicago. Tom's spirits started to soar. The beginning of any journey always drove his adrenaline level high. His last published article, for a health magazine, had explored the tremendous potential of a 6-week diet relying solely on plump prunes and the close proximity of a bathroom. Tom was desperately ready for an adventure. He walked to the front of the train and saw the twin diesel-electric engines that would be pulling the cap. He'd read about these monsters. They were General Electric P-42s, each weighing a staggering 268,000 pounds, cranking 16 cylinders and packing 42,000 horsepower. As his gaze lingered over these hulking machines, he imagined how wonderfully they might perform on the congested Washington Beltway. What a P-42 couldn't outrun, it would simply run over. Walking back on a track siding that ran under the station, he saw an old Hunter Green Railroad car that looked interesting. An Amtrak employee was nearby, so Tom asked what it was. The fellow answered, "That's Franklin D. Roosevelt's old train car, the Marco Polo, train number 7. It's owned by Norfolk and Southern now. They wine and dine VIPs there right on the spot." As they stood watching, a stretch limo pulled under the tunnel near the former Roosevelt train car. Tom said, "Are they having an early dinner on the Marco Polo? Perhaps with Churchill and Stalin?" he added with a smile. The man didn't get the joke. "Nope, some big shot getting on the Cap Limited. They bring them in that way, and then there's a ramp underneath the station the limo can go out. We do it for privacy, like sneaking movie stars through airports." "So who's the big shot getting on my train? Probably some political type, right?" The fellow looked at Tom. He appeared to be a veteran railroader with probably lots of terrific stories to tell, if only Tom had the time. "Well, if I let you in on that, it wouldn't be a secret now, would it?" Tom waited a bit to see who'd get out of the limo, but no one ever did. The odds of an eventual sighting were high, though, since once on the train, it would be difficult for the VIP to stay concealed. Give Tom Langdon a train flying down the tracks, pen, paper, trusty binoculars, and full indemnity, and he'd bag a VIP every day of the week. Today, the CAP's configuration of cars, called the consist in train speak, was two engines, one baggage car, three coaches, two sleeper cars, one dining car, and one dormitory transition car. The transition car was where most of the service crew was quartered. It had high and low doors that allowed the double-decker cars to have access to the single-level cars, hence the term transition car. Tom kept walking until he reached a sleeping car attendant and showed him his ticket. "Next sleeper car down, sir. Regina will take care of you," the fellow told him. Tom went to see Regina. She was standing in front of an impressively large 16-foot-tall double-decker train car that was called, in Amtrak parlance, a superliner, the heaviest passenger train car in the world. Trains, although some considered them an outmoded form of travel, had an undeniable mystery for Tom. He'd read most of the classic suspense yarns that had taken place on Rolling Stock, and the elements for edge-of-your-seat storytelling were all there. You had the romance of sophisticated yet unhurried travel in a confined space with a set number of suspects from all walks of life. In what he thought were the best of such stories, passengers held their breath in the darkness, blankets pulled to their chins because they could just sense something terrible was about to happen. Soon, with the tension at its peak, there'd come a slash of light, a scream, and a dull thud as a body fell. In the wee hours of the morning, the corpse, peepers wide open and skin pale as chalk, would be discovered by an incredibly dense traveling maid who'd scream her head off for about 10 minutes while a pair of brooding eyes watched from a shadowy corner. Anyone unmoved by such a scenario should check his pulse, Tom strongly felt. Regina possessed flawless dark brown skin and seemed to be too young to be working on a train or anywhere else. In fact, to Tom, she looked like a high school junior gearing up for her inaugural prom and first serious kiss. Tall and slender, she was personable and obviously enjoyed her work. She was wearing a red and white Christmas hat, the sort donned by Santa's helpers at the mall, and she was assisting the nervous young couple Tom had seen holding hands in the waiting area. The priest had already checked in and was hauling his big duffel inside the train. After Regina had finished with the couple, Tom stepped forward and showed her his ticket. She looked at the name and marked it off her list.
"Okay, Mr. Langdon, you're on the upper level, compartment D. Stairs are to your right and then left down the hall."
Tom thanked her and gingerly placed a foot on the august Capital Limited. His experience with sleeper cars was limited solely to viewing the movie North by Northwest, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, and starring the impeccably elegant Cary Grant, a nubile Eva Marie Saint, and a very sinister James Mason. Most fans of the movie remember the famous crop duster plane scene where Cary, dressed in his superbly tailored gray suit, is standing alone in the middle of vast, lonely farmland, waiting for a meeting with the mysterious George Kaplan, who, of course, doesn't exist. Some wily minds at the CIA had concocted Kaplan's identity for their own nefarious purposes. Those folks at the agency were always lying about something to make the world safe for democracy. Yet, to be fair, it was all in good fun and solely at taxpayer expense. Now, the movie scene that Tom remembered most was the one that featured a lot of kissing inside Eva Marie Saint's spacious sleeper compartment. Cary and Eva went at it pretty hot and heavy, even by today's standards. Watching it as a young man, hormones afire, Tom remembered thinking impure thoughts about all women everywhere, or at least those who looked like Eva Marie Saint. Having seen that film, he knew that his sleeper compartment would be elegantly appointed and spacious, have room for a couple of beds and feature a nice study area, a small foyer in which to formally receive visitors, a full bathroom and whirlpool tub, optional servant quarters, and perhaps an outdoor patio balcony combo.
There was a reason that at the end of the movie, Carrie and Eva had honeymooned in that very same sleeper compartment. It was bigger than any apartment Tom had ever had. He started to climb the stairs as instructed by Regina. With luggage, the going was a little tough, the stairs turning at tight 90-degree angles. He assumed all the extra space had been devoted to the mammoth sleeper compartments. Then he looked up and realized he faced a considerable obstacle. She was old, dressed in what looked to be a sleeping gown, although it was not yet 4 o'clock, and was teetering on the top step coming down. Tom was on the second to the top step. He only had one more step to go, one narrow little riser to navigate, before he was off to fantasize about Eva Marie and his rolling penthouse. "Excuse me," he said politely.
"Coming through,"
the woman announced in a thunderous baritone that actually made the rough, tough former war correspondent feel dangerously effeminate. "If you'll just let me squeeze past," he replied. But that was out of the question. She wasn't nearly so tall as Tom, but she was, to put it delicately, considerably wider in frame.
"Hi there, Regina," the woman called down.
"Hi there, Agnes Jo," said Regina.
Neither of them backing down, Tom and Agnes Jo engaged in an awkward tango, 1 foot forward, 1 foot back. Performed vertically on the stairs, it actually made Tom a little queasy. Finally, he said, "Agnes Jo, I'm Tom Langdon. I'm in compartment D. If you can just step back for a sec..." He never finished the sentence, because instead of stepping back, she gave him a little nudge. Actually, it was a meaty forearm launched to the right side of his head, which sent him, already off balance, stumbling back down the stairs where he hit bottom and fell flat on his back. Agnes Jo followed his plummet and was polite enough to gingerly step over his prostrate carcass. Tom very seriously doubted this was how Mark Twain had begun his cross-country railroad journey. Agnes Jo walked over to Regina, who was busy helping some other people on board, and luckily hadn't seen what had happened, for which Tom was grateful. After all, an elderly woman had just pulverized him at King of the Hill.
"There you go, honey pie. Thanks for taking my bags."
Agnes Jo handed Regina some cash. Tom picked himself up and headed over to Regina after glaring at the old woman as he passed her.
"I'll get your bags, Mr. Langdon. Just put them over there while I get everybody checked in."
"Well, thank you. And it's Tom," he said, handing Regina a handful of dollars. She graced him with a cute little look. He glanced at Agnes Jo, who was slowly making her way back up the stairs. "So have you been working on this train long?" he asked Regina.
4 years.
"That's a long time."
"Shoot, we have people been on this train 20 years.
Tom looked back at Agnes Jo, who was still on the same step. Her legs were moving, but she didn't seem to be ascending. It was actually fascinating to watch, sort of like witnessing pokey lava.
"So you know Agnes Jo?"
"Oh, sure, she's been riding this train for about, 10 years or so, I hear."
10 years? She must really like the ride."
Regina laughed. "I think she has family she goes to see. She's nice." Tom rubbed his head where nice Agnes Jo had walloped him.
"Is she on this sleeper car?"
"Yep, right next to you."
Oh, joy, joy, he thought. He went back to the stairway where Agnes Jo was, inexplicably still on the exact same step.
"Agnes Jo, do you need some help?"
"I'm fine, honey pie. Just give me a little time."
"Maybe if I get in front of you and pull."
Tom's plan was to get in front of her, run like hell, and lock himself in his magnificent suite with Eva Marie while Cary Grant kept guard outside.
"Just give me some space, sonny."
She finished this last retort with a heavy elbow that somehow found Tom's left kidney. By the time the pain had ceased and he was able to straighten his torso, Agnes Jo was gone. He slowly made his way to compartment D. Damn if he didn't feel like a war correspondent again.
Chapter 4. As Tom stood in the doorway of compartment D, it occurred to him that if Carrie and Eva Marie had shot the kissing scene here, North by Northwest would have been rated triple X.
He wasn't sure of the exact dimensions of this deluxe accommodation, but two normal strides later, he'd bumped into the opposite wall. There was no foyer, no study, no desk, no double beds that he could see, and he was reasonably certain that the balcony patio combo, whirlpool, and optional servant quarters were myths, too. There was a sink and a mirror and an outlet for an electric razor. The cabinet below was well stocked. He saw toilet paper, so there must be a bathroom hidden in here somewhere. There was a tiny closet in which to hang his coat, a large mirror on the far wall across from what he assumed was the bed, and what looked like an upper bunk as well. There was a chair and a fold-down table with a checkerboard engraved on it, which he could use as a desk. And the picture window was huge and gave an inviting view of the outdoors, where a few trickles of snow were starting to fall, getting him more into the Christmas spirit. The door to the compartment locked and had a heavy privacy curtain. Okay, it wasn't bad, he decided. In truth, space-wise, it easily beat out even first class on an airplane. This impression lasted until he opened the door and saw his private bathroom. Actually, according to the sign posted inside, this was the bathroom and the shower. He was expected to pee and shampoo in the same space? In his overseas reporting days, he'd actually endured showers consisting solely of camel spit, and that definitely wasn't by choice. His real dilemma here was one of capacity. He looked at his girth and then eyed the bathroom shower. He edged closer and studied the situation some more. He was reasonably certain that he could wedge himself inside this chamber. Of course, once in, it would take three or four strong men with heavy machinery to free him. And no doubt Agnes Jo would be standing there waiting to take a shot at the one good kidney he had left. He'd read about the unfortunate woman on a transatlantic flight who'd committed the unpardonable sin of flushing the toilet in the plane lavatory while she was still sitting on it. This seemingly innocent action somehow created a mighty suction vacuum that trapped her on the toilet seat. He'd wanted to write a note to the plane engineers inquiring why they hadn't tested for this unfortunate possibility. She endured the entire flight in the fully upright position until the plane landed and an elite crew armed with giant spatulas and baby oil stormed the lavatory and freed the poor hostage. If it had been Tom, he believed he would have gnawed off his legs and broken the seal himself. Unwilling to think about it anymore, he turned back and was about to sit down when he saw something flash by against the wall opposite the bed. At first it didn't register, it was so fast. But then it happened again. It was Agnes Jo. How could that be? This was a very peculiar definition of private accommodation. Then he saw the problem. The walls between compartments must open, perhaps for maintenance or reconfiguration or something, but the result was that he could see into the woman's room. He'd bivouacked with the aforesaid dirty, spitting camels and desert nomads whose last bathing experience had been at birth and various other unwashed persons with mortar fire as his alarm clock. Yet he'd never slept with an Agnes Jo, and he didn't really want to start now. As he went over to the wall to push it back into place, Tom peered through the crevice between their rooms and found himself cornea to cornea with the woman.
"You best not be peeping at me, sonny boy," she said. "Besides, you don't want to look at my old stuff, honey pie. Find yourself some girl closer to your own age."
Okay, Tom thought. The lady is the town eccentric, only on rails. He decided to play along.
"Well, your stuff looks pretty good to me. Now, don't make me call Regina."
"You don't want to do that. Why mess up a nice twosome with a third wheel?"
"Don't you try to sweet-talk me. It won't work, because I'm not that sort of girl.
But we could have a drink together in the lounge car after supper and get to know each other." She actually batted her eyelashes. "Now that's an offer I'd be a fool to refuse." She gave him a playful smile.
"I'm sorry about knocking you down the stairs, Tom. My hand must have slipped. If it had to happen, I'm glad it was you."
He turned and saw Regina standing there, his bags in her hand. She glanced over at the wall and shook her head. Did that wall pop out again? I told maintenance to check it.
Hi, Regina,
said Agnes Jo through the opening. She pointed to Tom. You watch that fella. He's slick.
Okay.
Tom pushed the wall back into place. Regina said, sorry about that.
That's okay. She seems pretty harmless.
Regina gave him a sly look.
I wouldn't be too sure about that.
She brought his bags in and then sat down on the edge of the couch that apparently transformed into a bed at midnight and pulled out a notepad.
I'll take your dinner reservation now. Dining car opens at 5:30. Or if you don't want to eat in the dining car, you can get some food from the cafe. It's in the lounge car, the one past the dining car, lower level. You'll see the staircase about halfway through on the right. Just show your ticket to Tyrone. He's the lounge car attendant. And tell him you didn't eat in the dining car. It's all free for sleeping car passengers.
I'll eat in the dining car. How about 7? She wrote this down.
While you're eating, I'll come in and get your bed made up. And we have soda and bottled water and coffee and fruit at the top of the stairs where you came up. I check it all the time so everything's fresh. Help yourself.
Is there a dress code or anything in the dining car?
Regina looked amused. Well, I've seen people wear just about anything a person can wear on this train.
Was it Tom's imagination or did her gaze flick in Agnes Jo's direction?
But most people are pretty casual. Lots of families on this train with little kids. What you're wearing is fine.
That's what I needed to know. He questioned her about the small size of his shower bath, and she told him that larger facilities complete with changing room were available on the lower level on a first-come, first-served basis. Most of the physically enhanced people opt for that, she added diplomatically. As she rose to leave, Tom said, I'm a journalist. I'm writing a story about my train trip across the country. She looked very interested.
Are you taking the Empire Builder to Seattle, the California Zephyr to San Fran, or the Southwest Chief to L.A.?
Southwest Chief to L.A.
That's a great train. The Chief has a cool history, and they're wonderful people on board. You'll have fun. Most people who work the Chief never want to leave.
Tom pulled out his notepad and started jotting things down. The way you describe it, the train almost seems like a person.
Well, they sort of are. I mean, you spend so much time on them, you learn their quirks, their strengths and weaknesses. Some are more temperamental than others, some more forgiving. It's sort of like having a relationship. I know that sounds strange, but that's just the way it is.
Well, some of the relationships I've had dating a 100-ton diesel might be a welcome change. Regina laughed.
My mother, Roxanne, works on the Southwest Chief as Chief of Onboard Services. That's the big boss. I'm going to see her when we get into Chicago. I'll let her know you'll be on. Now she can tell you some stories.
Is that common? I mean, do lots of family members work for Amtrak?
Well, I've got my mom and I don't know how many uncles and aunts and cousins and such spread all over. That's how I found out about working on the trains. And my son works for Amtrak, too. He's a coach cleaner.
Tom stared at her. Your son? You look like you just got out of high school.
Agnes Jo was right. You are slick.
She smiled shyly.
But thanks for the compliment. And you get some really famous people as passengers. Singers, athletes, movie stars, and they're all nice for the most part.
Her expression grew more serious.
Where I come from working on the train, that's something special. People look up to you. It's cool, you know?
Tom nodded. This element really intrigued him. He'd have to work it into his story.
You think some of the other people on the train will talk to me?
Oh, sure. I'll spread the word.
Everybody who works on a train has stories to tell.
I bet they do. As she left, Tom felt the train start to move. Diesel-electric trains have no need of a transmission, so there were no obstinate gears to shift. The resulting acceleration was smoother than the finest automobile on the road. Tom checked his watch. It was 4:05 exactly. The legendary Capital Limited, carrying Tom Langdon on a mission, was on its way.
Chapter 5. Cleared for takeoff by rail traffic control,
The Capital Limited soared down the metal and wood-ribbed runway, lifting off cleanly. It dipped its stainless steel-sheathed wings in salute to a passing band of birds, flushed out a nest of lobbyists plotting near the Capitol, and headed west, as Mark Twain had in his relative puberty. The young Sam Clemens had made the trek from Missouri to the Nevada Territory on a bouncy overland stagecoach, sleeping on mailbags at night and riding on top of the stage in his underwear by day. While he encountered much that was beautiful and rare, he also fought alkali deserts, desperados, ornery Mexican pugs, bad food, and boredom, while Tom Langdon was pulled along by 1,000 tons of raging horsepower and enjoyed a comfy bed, toilet, and Agnes Jo in the next room. Tom wasn't yet certain whether he or Mark Twain had gotten the better travel deal. He called Lelia on his cell phone. He hadn't told her about the train trip because he wanted to surprise her. She was certainly surprised, but not exactly the way he intended. Her reaction made him thrilled that there were currently about 3,000 miles separating them. She yelled into the phone,
"You're taking a train all the way across the United States of America? Are you insane?"
The way she said it, Tom was beginning to think he was. "Folks used to do this all the time, Lelia."
"Right, during the Stone Age."
"It's for a story about Christmas." He didn't want to share with her the other reason he was doing it, because he wasn't really sure how she figured into his future, at least the one he hoped to discover on this trip.
"I've chartered a private jet that leaves at 6 p.m. sharp on Christmas Eve."
"Well, I've got my skis. I'll be there. The train gets into L.A. that morning."
"What if it's late?"
"Come on, it's a train. We make our station stops, we pick up passengers, we let out passengers, we roll along, and we get into L.A. in plenty of time." He heard her let out a long sigh. Actually, lately, she'd been letting out many long sighs. They had that seemingly ideal relationship where they didn't have to live with each other every day, where issues of cooking, cleaning, which end of the toothpaste gets squeezed, or who gets what side of the bathroom weren't present to produce a destructive force on the otherwise happy couple. They ate out a lot, took romantic walks along the beach in Santa Monica, or shopped on Fifth Avenue, slept until noon, and then didn't see each other for a couple of months. If more marriages were put together like that, Tom firmly believed, the divorce rate would plummet. So he wondered, why all of this sighing of late?
"Just get here. I don't want to mess up everybody's plans."
"Everybody? Who's everybody?"
"The people going with us to Tahoe."
This was news to him.
"What people?" "Friends from the industry. My agent, my manager, and some others. We talked about this."
"No, we didn't talk about this. I thought this was just going to be you and me. We've done this the last 2 years."
"That's right, and I thought a change would be nice."
"Meaning what? That you're getting bored being with just me?"
"I didn't say that."
"You didn't have to. The army of people you invited into our Christmas said it loud and clear."
"I don't want to argue about this. I just thought that a nice group of people together for Christmas at Tahoe would be fun. You know most of them. It's not like they're strangers. And it's not like we won't be spending time alone. We will. I only booked us one bedroom, honey. And I bought a new teddy just for you. It has a Christmas theme, a naughty one,"
she said in a breathless tone. It was no wonder the lady made such a good living with her pipes. It had always bothered Tom that women thought they could win an argument with a man simply by appealing to his baser instincts, by holding out the mere possibility of award-winning carnal knowledge. It was the gender battle equivalent of a preemptive nuclear strike. He thought it unfair and, quite frankly, disrespectful of the entire male population. And yet, he heard himself saying, "Look, baby doll, I don't want to argue either. I'll be there on time, I swear." He clicked off and for a few moments had visions of naughty teddies dancing in his head. "Sometimes I'm such a guy," he thought ruefully. While he was chiding himself, there was a bustle of movement in the train corridor. By the time Tom opened his compartment door and drew his bead,
All he could see of the passing group was a trailing arm and leg. Though he'd only gotten a glimpse, there was something familiar about that arm and that leg. He assumed they were heading to another section of sleeping compartments. VIPs, of course, would have first-class accommodations. He thought about following them to see if it was actually the folks from the limousine, but concluded he'd catch up to them later. He sat back down and watched the scenery go by. The ride had been very smooth so far, and the sound of the revolving train wheels was soothing. It really wasn't a clickety-clack sound, he decided. It was more of an extended hum, and then hush, hum, and then hush, and then a big old sis-boom-ba. It was good to know that he had that weighty issue worked out. The first stop was Rockville, Maryland, barely 25 minutes after leaving Washington. Near Rockville was St. Mary's, a modest white church located on a small hill. It was here that F. Scott Fitzgerald was buried, for no other apparent reason than in fulfillment of his request to be planted for eternity in the country. Tom made a mental note to write out very specific instructions concerning his own future internment, then pulled out his laptop and entered some observations for his story, though he hadn't really seen all that much. Besides being mauled by Agnes Cho and humbled by Lelia, the trip thus far had been fairly sedate. He got up to see whom he could find to talk to. The train started up again, and he placed one hand against the wall in the corridor to steady himself. Somebody had strung holiday garlands up along the passageway, and there was even a Christmas wreath on the wall next to the door connecting the train cars. As he passed Compartment A, the elderly priest he'd seen in the waiting area earlier came out and bumped into him as the train rocked along. "Hello, Father," Tom said, cutting a handshake short to help steady the older man. Eleanor Carter was Catholic, and wherever in the world she and Tom had happened to be, they'd gone to Mass. She always joked that she'd just keep hammering away, and at some point Tom would either be saved or spiritually lobotomized. Actually, he'd briefly wanted to be a priest when he was in high school. As a teen, he was skinny and awkward, growing far too quickly for his tendons and coordination to keep up. That and his startling and persistent acne made him incredibly unpopular. As a result, he contemplated a career of solitude, introspection, and prayer. Only two things stopped him. He wasn't Catholic, and then there was that annoying vow of celibacy. After he had learned about that requirement, Tom wanted to be a rock star instead. "Retired now," the holy man said amiably, "though I still dress like a priest because I own no other clothes beside a chocolate-brown polyester leisure suit from the 1970s that I still ask forgiveness for." "Once a priest, always a priest,"